This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
There will be, I think it's only fair to warn you, a quiz on the program today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the first day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It's not going to be hard, our quiz, just a little test of how closely you are paying attention to the news of the day. President Trump is back, as you know, from Osaka and the G20 meeting there and his sit down with Chinese President Xi Jinping, at which a trade truce, it's being called, was reached. And herewith now our quiz. This was the second meeting between the two men in something less than 7 months, with basically the same issues on the table each time. They met at a G20 in Argentina in December. So here is what we're going to do. We are going to tell you what Wall Street analysts said about the progress made at each meeting. You just have to guess which meeting they were talking about, Argentina in December or Osaka in June, all right? Here you go. This is analysis from Goldman Sachs of one of those two meetings. We are not going to tell you which one.
The outcome of the meeting between Presidents Trump and Xi at the G20 summit is mostly as expected, with a delay in pending U.S. tariff increases agreed while negotiations continue. No substantive progress was announced on the main issues in the dispute.
So what do you think? December in Argentina or Osaka in June? While you think about that, here is more Goldman analysis. And just to make it more difficult, you knew this was coming, right? This is about the other meeting, not the same meeting as that first bit. Here you go.
U.S. and Chinese negotiators agreed to keep talking, with the U.S. postponing a planned escalation of tariffs by 2 months and China agreeing to resume purchases of agricultural and other goods, among other modest short-term concessions.
I know, tough, right? Because they basically said the same thing. The first one, just for the record, was the most recent meeting, Osaka. The second cut was from Argentina. Talks, we are told, will resume with Beijing on those substantive issues not talked about at the sit-downs in the next couple of weeks. There were a lot of optics from the president's trip overseas, meetings with Xi and Vladimir Putin, the excursion to North Korea that he took. But while all of that was grabbing the headlines, economic reality was rearing its ugly head. A report from the Institute for Supply Management says factory activity in this country barely grew at all last month. Another survey shows manufacturing has been slowing down in Europe as well, and has been for a while now. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on that.
When the Institute for Supply Management wants to get a sense of how manufacturers are doing, it doesn't just ask them how much stuff they're making. It also asks how many people they employ, whether they're getting the supplies they need. Timothy Fiore runs the ISM Survey Committee and says factories have what they need to manufacture their goods.
Suppliers are able to pretty much deliver what you want when you want it now. Production and employment did pretty well.
But Fiore says there's a component missing, demand. In June, new factory orders fell to their lowest level in over 3 years. Some of that is because of the strong U.S. dollar, but the real issue is the trade war. Fiore says it's hard to sell stuff abroad when other countries are imposing counter tariffs on your products.
46% of our comments were related to tariffs, and of that, 9% included the comments around the Mexican border.
The trade war is a big part of why manufacturing in Europe is down, too. A survey from IHS Markit says factory activity in Europe has been contracting for 5 months. Liz Ann Saunders is chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab.
We're in a global manufacturing recession, and there's nothing in numbers like this that suggest we're pulling out of that anytime soon.
Even if tariffs go away, there are plenty of complicating factors weighing down global demand. Europe's economy continues to slow down. There's uncertainty over labor markets. There's uncertainty over Brexit. But Veronique de Rougie at the Mercatus Center says removing tariffs will go a long way toward helping manufacturers.
You lift the tariffs and suddenly, overnight, you reduce production costs quite significantly.
As one economist told me today, the good thing about beating your head against a wall is that it feels better when it stops. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All of that said, yes, and if you will, some congratulations are in order for a job well done. We are now officially in the longest period of economic growth this country has seen since they started keeping track back in the middle of the 1800s or so. The growth spurt between 1991 and 2001 was the previous record holder, which somehow seems really far away. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to do some economic boom times compare and contrast.
Try to think of a working class character starring in one of the top TV shows today. Grey's Anatomy? Nope. NCIS? No. But in 1991, two of the top four shows focused on working class characters. Roseanne.
Well, I've had worse jobs.
Also, Cheers. Sometimes you wanna go where everybody knows. Lindsay Piezo watched reruns of Cheers as a bored teenager. Now she's chief economist at Stifel, with a more nuanced view of Roseanne and the Cheers crowd.
Maybe those typical jobs were more highlighted or respected in the 90s economy.
Piexa says it was easier to make a living as a blue-collar worker in the 90s. Technology wasn't replacing so many workers. It was just making everybody more productive.
We were talking actually about an average growth rate of 3.6%.
That's close to double the current economic growth rate. And the spoils of growth in the 90s were spread out more evenly. Now, according to the Federal Reserve, more than a third of the economic gains are going to the richest 1%. Also, says John Moen, economics professor at the University of Mississippi, in the 90s,
I think the United States was still sort of the dominant world political leader, unlike today,
when we're not so insulated from worldwide economic trends. Another thing that was different in the 90s, Kathy Busjancic of Oxford Economics says, home ownership took off.
And then it continued to rise at a very steep pace all the way through to about 2005.
Busjancic says you could argue that home ownership rates got too high, leading to the housing crisis. But now, she says, it's gotten too hard to buy a house. And those blue-collar workers celebrated on TV just aren't sharing in this recovery. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders reacted to the weekend's economic news the way you'd figure traders would react to the weekend's economic news, even though, as we were saying a minute ago, it's the same economic news as 7 months ago. A record high here and there, general lightness of being. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a music industry story today that's part mergers and acquisitions, part intellectual property, and part life in this digital economy. Over the weekend, the label that owns the rights to Taylor Swift's first six albums, Big Machine Records, got bought by a company called Ithaca Holdings, news which was not well received by the pop star herself. At issue is the ownership of Swift's master recordings. Ann Steele had the story for the Wall Street Journal. Ann, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe we ought to start sort of at the very beginning here, and you tell me what masters are and why Taylor Swift doesn't own hers.
The masters that we're talking about here are basically the copyright to recordings of Taylor Swift's music. You know, when she signed her first deal as a 15-year-old, you know, undiscovered artist at the time, she had very little leverage. So it's pretty typical for a label who signs you to own those copyrights. As Taylor progressed in her career, she was able to, in her new deal signed just last year, to own all of her music going forward. But her old deal still stands
in perpetuity. So what has happened is that this guy named Scooter Braun, who's a sort of a he's an agent and he's a record label guy, and he's got a holding company that does a bunch of this stuff. He has bought the record label that controls Taylor Swift's rights. So now every time a Taylor Swift song gets downloaded or played on the radio, this guy, Scooter Braun, who owns Ithaca Holdings, he gets some slice of that money.
Correct.
And that clearly does not sit well with Taylor Swift.
No, I think Taylor Swift, when, you know, looking at what was next for her, she said herself in her blog post that she was, you know, looking to regain ownership of her recordings. But the only way for her to do that would have been for her to re-sign with Big Machine. But she decided to go elsewhere and bet on the future.
What's the driving force behind this deal in this new age of streaming music that in which we live?
Definitely the driving force behind this deal is to have this catalog that, you know, has streamed well and will continue to stream well, all these hits. That's important for any company that's in the music world at this point.
Yeah, you say catalog and I hear content, right? That's what this is. This is a content play.
That's exactly what it is.
Do you suppose there's a way that Taylor Swift can get these masters eventually? I mean, she wrote a whole blog post, called herself sad and grossed out, is not at all pleased about this. Is there a way that she comes out sort of ahead-ish?
I think that's up to Scooter Braun. I think any sort of a deal where she would regain ownership of her masters going forward be unconventional, but who knows? If anyone is going to pave a new route, it could be Taylor Swift.
Right. It bears a mention here that Taylor Swift is not the only artist to have lost control of her masters, right? I mean, the Beatles come to mind for sure.
Yep, and then Prince, you know, had a similar situation with Warner Music back in the day as well. And so she's certainly not the first one to have gone through this.
Yeah, and probably not the last, frankly, right?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Ann Steele covers music for the Wall Street Journal, talking today about Taylor Swift. Ann, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
The makeup business of late has not been as easy, breezy, or beautiful as the big makeup brands might have hoped. Max Factor, Clairol, CoverGirl as well have been mainstays of pharmacy shelves for decades now. But their parent company, Coty Beauty, announced a big restructuring plan today because the legacy mass market beauty brands, like those owned by Coty, have been losing market share as people move to luxury and specialty products. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on what's happening in the drugstore beauty aisle.
In decades past, big beauty brands were all over the airwaves.
Maybe she's born with it.
Maybe it's Maybelline.
And all over store displays. Consumers still do the majority of their shopping for beauty products in pharmacies and big box retailers, but the shelf space devoted to the legacy brands has been shrinking, says Larissa Jensen, a beauty business analyst with NPD Group.
I mean, I walked into a CVS recently and saw a whole collection of K-beauty products.
That's Korean beauty products, which are all the rage if you haven't yet been turned on to the wonders of snail slime serums and pig collagen face masks. They're part of an explosion of niche brands that have fragmented the beauty landscape and made their way onto mainstream shelves, says Americus Reed, a marketing professor at the Wharton School.
Organics, naturals, sort of skincare beauty products that are meant for different types of skin. So there's a diversity and inclusion kind of component.
In addition to increased competition, the big brands are also grappling with savvier consumers, says May Karwowski of the marketing agency Obviously.
All of that conversation and all of that product consideration is happening even before someone walks into the store.
In online forums and on Instagram and YouTube accounts like Jeffree Star's.
Today we're going to try out a crazy drugstore mascara.
But Karwowski says the rise of beauty influencers isn't all bad news for the big drugstore brands, thanks to the phenomenon known as dupe videos, short for duplicates.
An influencer will start talking about one amazing product that is very expensive, and then they'll list the dupes that are the drugstore versions that are sometimes, you know, a 20th of the price.
And easy to pick up when you stop for cat litter and cold medicine. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think it's just sort of unpalatable for almost everybody involved.
Nothing like a surprise medical bill, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 117 points today, 0.4%, 26,717. The NASDAQ banked 84 points, that is 1%, 8,091. The S&P 500 up 22 points, 0.75%, 29.64, a record high there. Stocks began what is expected to be a week of light trading because of the Independence Day holiday with some optimism, mainly because of the news that Beijing and Washington have agreed to resume trade talks, even though that is the same news on trade talks as 7 months ago. The optimism helped lift a lot of tech stocks that rely both on Chinese manufacturing as well as sales in China. Apple up 1.8% for the day. Chipmakers also generally ended things higher. Micron with a gain of nearly 4%. Qualcomm up almost 2% today. Staying with China for just a bit longer, Wynn Resorts rose almost 6% as gambling revenue in Macau, the Chinese territory that is the world's biggest gambling hub, rose higher than expected in June. Hang Seng today down just a tad, by the way. That's in Hong Kong. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. As we mentioned up at the beginning of the program, there has been, if not substantive progress, certainly some gestures of goodwill in the U.S.-China trade relationship. Among them, the White House says China promising to buy more American soybeans, a crop on the leading edge of steep retaliatory tariffs from Beijing since last July. We've got a soybean farmer that we talk to every now and then, but we are going to go elsewhere in the soybean economy today, somebody on the market side of that crop. So we dialed up Al Kleiss. He's the managing director of Kleiss Commodity Advisors. Mr. Kleiss, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you for calling. I'm glad to be with you.
I'm sure you were following the news over the weekend of these trade talks. First of all, what's your gut telling you on the news of the soybean purchases that we are told are going to be coming?
Well, I think the trade is very skeptical because right now, as we're talking, the soybean market is down about 14 cents, testing major support. So We've heard some of these false hopes before, and as a trader, we're always kind of skeptical. And right now, we need to see some real orders and some action come in, not just the talk of potential orders being placed for both ag and food products.
Well, so let me cast your mind back in time then to a year ago, plus or minus, when this whole thing started. Are you feeling any better that they're even talking now?
Well, I think you're always better off to be talking, but it seems like there's certain positions that neither party wants to give in on. And in the meantime, that China continues to have a 25% tariff on all U.S. soybeans going in, and it's been pretty devastating to the profits in our industry.
So let me ask you this, sir. As you sit there watching your screens, what are you learning or what are you intuiting about the global soybean supply chain as you watch the numbers move?
It certainly has been rattled. We had soybeans trading at about $10.50 a bushel. As we're talking here today, we're about $8.85 on nearby soybeans. You've went from making about a dollar a bushel to now losing about a dollar per bushel on the soybeans that you produced in 2018 and the crop you hope to harvest in 2019.
Well, that seems to be a losing business proposition, Mr. Kleiss.
Well, it is. What we have seen recently is that we're going to be seeing a lot fewer acres come in soybeans. Unfortunately, we're giving away a lot of our hard-earned markets that we've developed in China to both Brazilian and Argentine farmers.
Well, talk to me more about that, because supply chains, as you know, take a long time to establish. They can be vaporized pretty quickly. How long do you think it'll take to get the U.S. soybean market back on track, if at all?
Well, I think we are going to see a lot of shift going forward to where we will never be as dominant producing soybeans for China as we were before. We export about half the soybeans out of the U.S., and about half of that half, so 25% of our soybeans, we're going to China. Now China has been able to get almost all the soybeans they need from Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, Ukraine, all other sources. We're ending up shipping more soybeans to Europe and other countries in Southeast Asia, so the supply chain has changed, but net-net, we're still running about 300 million bushels less in exports than we did in 2018 and 2017.
When you make your, what I'm assuming is your daily round of calls to your clients and those for whom you broker these beans, what are they telling you?
They're pretty upset. They've initially thought that we would see this trade dispute resolved pretty quickly. There's a lot of people that are in pretty tough financial shape now. We've had historically a very late wet spring, And so we're looking at less than normal yields, but also right now we're looking at prices that are pretty dismal.
Before we turn on the recorder, sir, you said you'd been doing this for a long time, 40-something years, right?
That's correct. I'm 66. I started when I was 22.
You ever seen anything like this?
I guess this would be comparable back to the grain embargo that we had when Carter stopped selling grain to the Russians.
And,
but that was just like one hard punch to the gut. All of a sudden, it was just done. Prices went down sharply and then started to recover. This has been more like a 12-round drag-out brawl, and it's just wearing people out.
Al Kleiss, he's the managing director of Kleiss Commodity Advisors. We got him in Minnesota. Sir, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the call.
Healthcare is complicated, part 3795, to wit, in and out of network care. You know the deal, right? Providers in your insurance network are covered. Providers out of network either aren't covered at all or wind up costing you a whole bunch of money. But let's say something bad happens and you wind up in the emergency room. You have just entered the healthcare economy in this country at one of its most expensive points, in part because ER doctors aren't always in a patient's insurance network, even if the hospital is. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer has more on this key reality of our healthcare infrastructure.
Todd Johnson's teenage son had a nasty mountain biking accident last year, so he went to a hospital that he thought was in his insurance network.
Here at home, I knew, or thought I knew, which hospitals were covered under my insurance.
The doctor yanked out a 2-inch hunk of tree protruding from his son's arm. Johnson, a school teacher in Knoxville, paid the copay and didn't think much else about it.
And then...
Johnson sifts through the stack of bills that started arriving in the mail. One was from the physician staffing firm, an $1,800 charge.
$1,840.15, to be exact.
What Johnson confronted has become the quintessential surprise medical bill, a hospital in network, but doctors who aren't. There have been several nationwide studies that look at this. One found the ER mismatch happens in as many as 1 in 5 ER visits. That's because these days the doctor is usually employed by a physician services company that basically runs the ER. And there are two massive firms based in Tennessee that have quietly come to dominate this sector nationally. One is Team Health. Leif Murphy is the CEO and says his firm won't join a network if insurance companies won't pay enough.
If we are not a network and we are not a network because we've been offered an unreasonably low level of reimbursement.
But that can be a strategic move by the staffing firms, says health economist Zach Cooper at Yale University. They're betting that insurers will hear enough complaints about surprise bills and agree to pay doctors more.
And when this is really a deliberate strategy pushed by private equity-backed emergency physician staffing companies, I think it's just sort of unpalatable for almost everybody involved.
Cooper has researched the two largest firms, Team Health and Envision, and his work has informed proposals advancing in Congress, including one that would require doctors and hospitals to join the same networks.
My hope is that regulation shifts the balance of power and makes the market function a whole lot more effectively for all of us.
But physician firms say they're the ones being overpowered. While companies like Team Health and Envision are worth billions of dollars, the big insurers are many times bigger, says Adam Brown. He's an ER doctor and senior vice president at Envision.
As insurance companies have consolidated, grown, and in some markets become the primary insurance provider of an entire market, sometimes even an entire state, the fairness of reimbursement has certainly shifted.
Brown's worried that eventually doctors will just have to take whatever insurers offer. But a lobbying group for health plans and insurers says they're just trying to keep monthly premiums low for patients, that networks make it easier to bargain for lower rates. But for now, it's up to patients to do their own bargaining, which is exactly what Todd Johnson in Tennessee did. Repeated phone calls with his insurance company resulted in dropping the out-of-network charges, but it wasn't long before his son had another mountain biking accident, a less serious toe injury, that sent him back to the ER. This time, Johnson came prepared.
Well, actually, I brought in a piece of paper that said I wanted them to sign. I acknowledge that the physicians that will service my child are in network, and they wouldn't sign that.
They ended up going home. preferring to do without care rather than risk a surprise bill they couldn't get out of. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today points for creativity department. IKEA has this online tool where you can design your own sofa, decide on the configuration, ottomans, sectionals, all that stuff. Now, with some prodding from, I guess you'd call them IKEA superfans, the company has released a free downloadable font in which the letters are made up of couch parts. Sofa Sans, it's called, S-O-F-F-A, in that way that IKEA has of spelling things. This is one of those where it's better to see than to hear. S-O-F-F-A is what you need to Google. It's actually pretty cool, I think. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 117 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ, 84 points to the good, that is 1%. S&P 500 up 22 to a record high, 0.75%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.